We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And this is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, the producer for the show. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. We're also very happy to have you back on the program once again for the first time this year. One of our favorite guests, May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who studies insects. And several times in the year, generally when it's warm, we have her here and give people the opportunity to call in and ask questions about insects that they have seen. We always say, save your extermination questions. That's not what we do. The idea when she is here is we try to just amaze ourselves by talking about all the many interesting, unique forms that insects take and the different ways they make their living. So we do that. But generally now for some time, the first time we see her is here while it's still winter to give her an opportunity to talk about an event which she pioneered, which of course now has become world famous, made her, she probably thinks, you know, if I got as much attention for my research as I did for this, I'd be doing great. This is the Insect Fear Film Festival. The 28th annual festival is taking place on the campus on Saturday, February 26th, in the Follinger Auditorium. It's free. It's always been free. And the idea is here it's an opportunity to look at some entertainingly bad movies that have to do with insects. And I think also she and her colleagues there in the department think this is also an opportunity to sneak in a little education here around the sides to deal with all of the misinformation that we get about insects. So we'll talk a little bit about the festival. And as usual, when she's here, if people have insect questions, well, we can take those, whatever you want to do. 333-9455 is the number. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. What is that? That's 800-222-9455. And you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So any way you want to participate in the show. Well, glad to have you back. I'm glad to see you.
Every February, me and Punxsutawney Phil.
Two great institutions, May Barenbaum and the groundhog. Maybe you would like to tell the story once again about how this whole thing got started, how it is you happened to do your first festival, because it changed the course of your life.
In many ways. And so the idea actually came from when I was a graduate student. I was walking on the campus at Cornell University. I noticed a poster, a flyer that said the Asian American Society was hosting a Godzilla festival. And I thought, well, there's a group that has a sense of humor about its identity, or at least how it's perceived. I wonder if entomologists could do the same thing. So I thought we could have an insect fear film festival. I pitched the idea to the department head at the time at Cornell, who thought it was too undignified and maybe we could show some documentaries. And that was not the idea at all. So I kind of shelved it until I came here and worked a couple years as a professor to establish my scientific credentials, and then went to my department head here and pitched the same idea. And he thought it was a wonderful gave me the green light, and so that meant I could put on a festival. But I didn't know anything about putting on a film festival, so I wrote a letter to the head of the unit for cinema studies here and asked if they'd be interested in co-sponsoring. And I got a very politely worded letter back from the assistant director of the unit saying they were very busy with French and German retrospectives and didn't really have the time, but he'd be happy to help me with whatever questions I might have. So that assistant director at the time was Richard Laskowski, whom I ended up marrying 6 years later. So we've actually published together several articles on insects in the movies, including our first joint publication, which was called Insects in Animated Film or Not All Bugs Are Bunnies, and which actually came out the month of our honeymoon, which was at the International Congress of Entomology at Vancouver, British Columbia. I sometimes think it might not be very easy to be married to an entomologist. So.
Mm-hmm.
But we were optimistically called our 1984 festival the first annual. We didn't know there'd be another one, much less 27 more. So it's been a whole lot of fun, and we haven't really had to repeat too many movies. Our first feature is actually a repeat, but it's from 1985, and I think there are only about three of us who may still be around from that second festival. So,
well, somebody, a colleague, asked me to ask you how it is that you decide on your
theme,
and then how it is that you go out looking for movies.
Well, sometimes it goes the other way around. When there's the number of thematically linked movies reaches a critical mass, then I figure we can do a festival. So that's the way it was with Wasps. We'd never done a Wasp festival before. It's nice, too. One of the requirements for the festival, our first feature is always fairly family-friendly. And movies, particularly in the last 15 years or so, are by and large not very kid-friendly. Special effects are incredibly gruesome. So we often reach back to the 50s. So we have a limited supply of films from the 50s and virtually unlimited supply of gruesome things from contemporary era. So when Sci-Fi Channel started featuring movies about killer wasps, I thought, oh, time is right.
All right. So that is, in fact, the theme this year, killer wasps. And we'll talk some about the movies. I'll tell you what, we have a caller, so rather than make that person wait for a long time, we'll bring him in. And anybody else, of course, who would like to call should feel welcome. And the caller is in Indiana, line number 4. Right here. Hello.
Back.
Hi.
Pretty good. You know, I'm the one that should have been an entomologist, but went into philosophy and math. Anyway, two things. One, I'm hoping you. It was a book that was mentioned on National Public Radio on one program, and they did it just bam, bam, and that was it. Didn't say author or anything. It's Wild Animals at Home. But from the information they gave, it sounded to me like about mites, spiders, and other, you know, little fellows like that running around inside your house and basement. And I wonder if you knew anything about it at all.
I don't, but I see David Inge just hit the computer here.
I can see if that is, in fact, the title, I can...
That's what it's supposed to be, Wild Animals at Home. And unfortunately, I never heard the author or authoress, and I don't even know if they gave it.
I was hoping...
They have a habit sometimes, you know, just get this, and they have a habit sometimes of giving names with 26 letters and don't tell you how to spell them.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, and the librarians where I am, they're sort of tired of me doing that. Hmm. The second question is more along real lines. when it got pretty warm a while back, not too long ago, I sat on my balcony, and I swear to God, I saw some moths.
Yeah, not out of the realm of possibility.
Okay, well, I'm glad, because I thought, I'd, the vision's not like it used to be. Anytime I can something with, you know, like 2.5x magnum binoculars or something, opera glasses, of course, it was gone. And then I saw a few other things that had, well, best I can say, it shimmered in the sunlight.
Well, a lot of the insects spend the winter as adults, and they are not, it depends on the species, but they're not sort of metabolically completely inactive. Mm-hmm. And particularly those that overwinter as adults, one of the ecological incentives for, you know, spending that this period of environmental unpleasantness as an adult is you can get a jump on everybody else however early spring arrives. So often all it takes is an elevation in temperature and for these individuals to reactivate. And there are both butterflies and moths that spend the winter as adults just waiting for the weather to warm up. And bees, in fact, bees don't even go into this state of hibernation or diapause. They just basically huddle in their hives and shiver to keep themselves warm and look forward to warm days because that's when they fly out of the hive to defecate. That's a really big day. Because
I'm glad I got to see that.
Yeah, they hold it in all winter because they don't want to foul their own hive. And on a nice day, they come out, unload, and come back in. So.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. This has been one of my peaks. Thanks a lot.
All right.
I'm looking for your work now.
Well, with that thought, look forward to the next nice day. Be glad you're not a bee.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And our guest is May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. She is a scientist who studies insects and occasionally is on the program. And we talk about insects. So if you have insect-related questions, as long as they're not extermination questions, you can give us a call.
Any luck on that book?
I went to Amazon here, and what I find is that there are a couple of things by that title, but it's actually a title of a book by someone named Ernest Thompson Seton, and it was published.
Oh, that's an old one.
It was originally published, published in 1913.
Yeah, I remember that.
But it looks like it has recently been reissued. I don't know, was this someone who was a well-known
naturalist?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe that's what the guest was referring to. He heard some mention to that, and that if you go to, yes, he was a Scots-Canadian who was noted author, wildlife artist, and one of the founding pioneers of the Boy Scouts of America. And he died in 1946. So it's possible that this is something that he wrote that for some reason had been out of print, had recently been brought back.
There's two other books along those same lines. One is called, that are also 20 years old or more. One's called The Life That Lives on Man, which I thought was a wonderful book. It's basically about, you know, creatures that use us as housing. And then there was one called The Secret Life of Houses, which I think was based on a PBS or BBC documentary that had some wonderful photography, macro photography of creatures that cohabit with us without our knowledge.
And probably if people knew, if they actually could see the stuff that was not only living in the home, but was living on us, they'd probably be totally creeped out.
Yeah, well, that brings up the eyebrow mites and we'll save that for another day.
All right.
Technically, they're not insects either. So.
Let's talk to somebody in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Can you tell me what slugs do in the winter?
Well, slugs aren't insects, so I don't feel morally responsible for them. But to be perfectly honest, I'm not exactly sure what life stage that almost assuredly they have a hibernation-like state or a diapause-like state. But I'm not exactly sure whether it's eggs or adults. They're mollusks. They're in a whole different phylum from the insects and their relatives. And I should know this, but I never have looked for slugs in the winter. So maybe another caller who's a little more familiar with gastropods can fill us in. But it's a good question. Do you have a reason for asking about slugs? Or
curiosity.
Just curiosity. Okay. Not a visceral hatred or anything. So.
Oh, no. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Sure. Thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL, will-talk@illinois.edu.
Now, you know I'm going to feel bad about this for the next month. I really should know where slugs go in the winter, and I don't know.
No, you know, you can't be responsible for it's enough that that you feel that people should be able to ask you. Now, how many different insect species are there?
Well, there's over 900,000 with names. How many there are remaining to be discovered is a subject of considerable debate. Some estimates range on the low end from about 2 million, on the upper end to about 30 million. So keeping track of the 900,000 is a challenge.
That's enough. Yeah. That's enough. We don't expect you to know about slugs. Insects, okay. Any one of those 900,000, yes, you can feel bad about not knowing that. But slugs, no, we'll take that off the list. You want to talk some more about the movies that are up for
sure.
The festival?
Well, we're showing two feature films, as we usually do. The first one, which is the more family-friendly of the two, is a 1958 feature called Monster from Green Hell, which is epitomizes everything that was wrong with 1950s filmmaking. It's just incredibly low budget. Its basic plot is scientists are experimenting and shoot some rockets into outer space, and part of the payload in one rocket are some wasps for reasons that aren't exactly clear. The wasps are exposed to cosmic radiation. The rocket goes off course and crashes in the heart of Africa, whereupon a seven-week safari is launched to find this rocket and recover the payload, the wasp, which have apparently turned giant and are causing mass destruction in an area of Africa now known as Green Hell. What makes this a particularly bad film is that much of the footage is from a 1939 film called Stanley and Livingston, and it's just sort of randomly spliced in. And it's set in the 19th century, so you kind of drift back and forth between the 19th century and the 20th century, where they're shooting rockets, yet they're walking into the heart of Africa. And then you can see footage that appears to be African savanna, and then suddenly you're in the California Chaparral. I mean, clearly it's not Africa, if you know anything about plant communities. And the budget was so low, they only had enough money to build 2.5 giant wasps. So you never see like a swarm of giant wasps, just these same 2.5 wasps. And their wings are too tiny for them to fly. They don't look terribly menacing. They don't move very fast. And my favorite anatomical liberty that they've taken with insect biology is they do have compound eyes. They mm-hmm. recognize that insects have compound eyes, but they roll in their sockets, which I think is a very nice touch.
Well, our own Jim Meadows, host of Morning Edition, heard the promo and was intrigued enough to investigate the films that you were going to show. And he actually found an audio clip for us. This is a little bit of the trailer for this movie. So let's listen to that.
The jungle becomes the graveyard of man and beast as the mighty herd stampede in panic before the paralyzing fear of these monsters from the green hell.
The animals flee from green hell. This I have seen.
And there is something. Perhaps even monsters. But a thing of nature, not of evil spirits.
This is the drone of death. The terrifying sound of the monstrous cosmic ray mutations unleashed upon the jungle from a rocket run wild.
Can you guess how big the creature itself must be?
Yeah. But we won't have to guess at it, Dan. We'll see for ourselves.
Out of all mankind's millions, only a handful know the full horrifying danger. Their strange safari to fight the giant insect enemy, filmed with thrilling impact.
See, and some people thought that my voice was the drone of death. No, it's the giant wasp. So if that sounds like your idea of entertainment, ladies and gentlemen, coming up this weekend, Saturday, the Insect Fear Film Festival, it's free, and you can bring the kids at least for that one.
Yeah, that film won't scare anybody. In fact, the first time I saw it, I thought it was so boring. I couldn't stay awake for it. It was only when I realized that it was spliced together from multiple films and made no sense whatsoever that it actually became sort of hilarious to watch. So that's our first movie. Our second movie appeared on the Sci-Fi Channel in 2003, and it's called Swarmed. And it's about genetic modification and involving pesticide resistance that ends up unleashing killer yellow jackets onto a Midwestern town that happens to be sponsoring a hamburger barbecue cook-off contest. And, of course, the yellow jackets are attracted to meat, and the townspeople won't call off the festival because I know barbecue sauce magnate has too much invested in this, and the wasps predictably run amok. There's one great scene where flamethrower is used and a shotgun. I mean, all kinds of interesting alternative mechanisms for dispatching insects. So,
and these are actually normal size wasps.
Yeah, well, they're a little bit bigger than normal, but
they're not
huge.
Giant.
The Sci-Fi was so tickled that we wanted to showcase their festival that they actually didn't even charge us a video exhibition fee, and they sent the producer of the film. So we will have on hand Gordon Yang, the producer of Swarmed, and he'll be available after the film to answer questions and sort of give us insights into, say, why yellow jackets, why barbecue sauce. It should be an interesting evening, not only for entomophiles, but also for cinemaphiles as well.
All right. This is the Insect Fear Film Festival, 28th annual, this weekend on the campus, Follinger Auditorium, Saturday night. It's free, and you can bring the kids at least for the first movie, and it's a lot of fun. Been going on now for a long time. Achieved world fame. on this campus, something created by our guest, May Barenbaum. She's the head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. We do have somebody else who has a question, a serious one, no doubt. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. The other day when temperature went above 60 for a little while, I was amazed to see in my vehicle there was a baby mosquito already. And also I noticed one of the, I guess it's probably like 2 millimeter long ants that come in my house pretty much every season. And that day an ant came in also. I only saw one. So I was hoping you would be able to explain sort of like what goes on when the insects winter over, and, you know, is it just simply they slow down, and then when it gets warm they just start back up? I'll take your answer off.
Sure.
All right. Thanks.
Well, there are a lot of ways that insects cope with predictable bad weather, environmental unpleasantness, and winter is fairly predictable. So the major cue in the fall to get ready for this impending environmental unpleasantness, which, of course, for insects is particularly bad because they are not like us. They can't regulate their body temperatures like we do. They are they're called ectothermic for the most part. When the environmental temperatures fall, their temperatures fall as well. Some of them just get out of Dodge. They go south, believe it or not. Monarch butterflies migrate. You might have seen them sort of massing in late September and October, and they just fly to one overwintering site in the mountains of Michoacán, Mexico. Far more of them, though, that live in the temperate zone, end up sort of metabolically going into a state of essentially suspended animation, a lot like bears, only it's physiologically a little different. It's called diapause. And they stop eating. Basically, some of them build up antifreezes in their blood. Some of them actually freeze almost solid. Some of the midges actually overwinter and can freeze. I like to think of them as fridges rather than midges. But European corn borers overwinter and sort of leftover stalks, and they almost freeze solid. Others just basically slow down their metabolic rate to a fraction of what's normal and equip their blood with their hemolymph with antifreezes. And what life stage they spend the winter depends a lot on sort of their life cycle in general. And those that overwinter as adults have a jump on everybody else when the weather turns warm. It's well understood what sends most of these species into diapause, but the triggers to end diapause vary enormously, and sometimes it's just warming. So a lot of the mosquitoes around here do overwinter as adults. Some of them don't. Some of them overwinter as eggs. Some of them overwinter as larvae. But the ones that overwinter as adults are the first ones you see in the spring when the weather comes, because they don't have to finish developing. They're already made. And they're not baby mosquitoes, because if it looks like a mosquito, it's a grown-up. Because baby mosquitoes are little wiggly things that live in the water. So if it's in your car, unless your car has, problem with sort of radiator overflow or something, it's probably a full-grown but very small mosquito. Ants, too. Ants are social insects. And many of the social insects have figured, like honeybees, have figured out ways to kind of maintain activity at a low level all winter long, so it does not take much to get the adults up and around. It's whenever the weather warms up. Ants have some species of ants just go deeper down into the ground to escape the freezing layer. So it's one of the reasons it's hard every time we have strange winter weather. Somebody calls up an entomologist and says, "Well, is that good news or bad news for the bugs this summer?" And they're probably as many different answers as there are bugs, because there's so many different ways of coping with bad weather. Sometimes a warm winter is actually bad for insects, because they will invest in a certain amount of metabolic storage energy that they use up slowly. But if the weather warms up, then their metabolic processes speed up and they run through their fuel supply and end up sort of out of fuel before the weather turns suitable. Or before their food shows up. Ants, for example. Ants that normally wouldn't think of entering your house during the summer, in the early spring will come in because there's nothing for them to eat outside. The aphids aren't out yet. They like to eat aphid honeydew. The flowers aren't blooming yet, so they don't have nectar. So they go where the food is, and that's often your kitchen. Sometimes just wait a little bit for the weather to stay warm, and when everyone catches up to the ants, then the ants go back outside.
And they don't, they're, for people who are concerned about that, they're not living in your house. They're just
coming in. Well, some of them might be, actually.
Foraging. Some of them might be.
Hard to say. He said little tiny are like the Pharaoh ants, and they can live in your house. But like carpenter ants, well, they can live in your house, too.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I suppose they'd rather be living in a dead tree, but a piece of your house that happened to have gotten wet, that's good. That works for them.
Yeah.
That'll work. Yeah. You know, I did actually think something I wanted to ask you about, has to do with monarch butterflies. And apparently there is some good news after their numbers really being down, is that now for people who do things like count butterflies, they go to the places where they congregate and they find out that the numbers this year are significantly up from where they were last year.
Yeah, the monarch migration is one of these fantastic insect behaviors that really defies imagination. So all the monarchs from the eastern U.S., wherever they grew up, end up in September or October flying to this very restricted area of a mountain range in Mexico. And people have speculated, well, it seems like the conditions are absolutely ideal. There's a certain type of tree that grows there. The climate remains fairly stable. They're protected from weather irregularities. And people are very concerned about the overwintering site because there's been deforestation there that's changing some of the weather-related characteristics of the site, and people were worried that that would cause greater overwintering mortality. There's also been worries in the breeding range of the monarchs with development, herbiciding of roadsides, other sorts of factors. And people have been counting monarchs for many, many years. There's an operation called Monarch Watch that even involves marking and labeling and recapturing the monarchs. And the numbers were shockingly reduced the last couple of years, but they seem to be creeping back up to the more reassuring levels. So that's great because the monarch's particularly vulnerable, even though it's not a rare insect. It's our state insect, as a matter of fact. It's vulnerable because it has only one spot in the world where it can spend the winter. So that's, it doesn't put all its eggs in one basket. It puts all its adults in one basket. So that basket starts to fall apart, then the species is in big trouble.
May Barenbaum is our guest. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's a professor there. She's a scientist who studies insects, has authored a number of interesting books on the subject, many of them aimed at the general reader. So if you like bugs and you'd like to read about them, head down to the library, to the bookstore, look for her books. And also, if you'd like to see some bad movies about big bugs, well, it's time for the Insect Fear Film Festival. Killer Wasps is the theme this year, and it's happening on Saturday on the campus. And questions about insects are welcome, too, and the lines are full. So we'll get right back to it. Please, the one qualification is save your extermination questions. We got a guy for that. We'll do that later in the spring. But at this point, if you just like to indulge your curiosity, that's what we're doing. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think I need a vacation. And will-talk@illinois.edu is the email. For our next caller, Sycamore, Illinois, up where I used to go to school, near there. Line 4, hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
Your comments about the wintering over of insects was intriguing to me, particularly saying that they have their own antifreeze and that they can protect themselves. And I'm just curious to know if you or any other researchers have done some testing to see how cold the insects can actually withstand. Have you taken samples of some of these critters down to cryogenic temperatures to see at what temperature they actually cease to function permanently. And
actually,
I'll take
yeah.
my answer off the air.
All right, thank you.
That's been sort of a cottage industry for many years. People just want to see how far they can push it. And some of the answers are just staggering. I mean, some you might expect. There's only one so-called holometabolous insect that lives in Antarctica. Holometabolous insects are the ones that go through a pupal stage. They have complete development. And it is Belgica Antarctica. It's a little midge that essentially freezes solid. It's been the subject of considerable study because how it copes with such amazingly inhospitable conditions is a real mystery. But in terms of the absolute lowest temperatures ever recorded, these were the series of studies done in the 1950s by a guy named Howard Hinton, who was an interesting character in and of himself, all by himself. He studied an insect that undergoes what's called anhydrobiosis. It basically dries out as part of its life cycle, and it's called Polypidilium von der Planckii. It's in the same family as Belgica Antarctica. It's also a midge, a chironomid midge, and it lives in little tiny little puddles in Africa that dry up. And he actually did plunge it into liquid nitrogen. It survived. He boiled it. It survived. It survived without oxygen. It survived an mind, but I don't even know how he could come up with these conditions. I mean, they were so incredibly stringent. It's clearly an exceptional insect, but yes, they can go down to liquid nitrogen temperatures and survive. I was thinking, what a great pet. you never have to worry about mistreating this thing. So.
Hmm. Well, if you believe in natural selection, you could see if something lives in a particular ecosystem, you could see that it could get used to the worst of whatever conditions it
has. Experience.
But there's no place where it would normally experience both freezing and being boiled.
This condition of basically reducing the water content seems to confer protection against all kinds of things.
So it's the process is the mechanism that's key.
Incidentally keeps them safe from conditions they won't experience except on Mars or something. Uh-huh. Certainly not on Earth. So.
All right, very good. Well, I thank the caller for the question. Let's go back to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the process of a caterpillar turning into a butterfly.
Okay.
So I kind of always imagined that this was sort of, you know, the thing is cocooned up and it rearranges itself into a butterfly. But recently I read that it maybe is more like sort of turns into mush and then regrows a butterfly. And I wonder if you could sort of describe in more detail what actually happens in that process.
Sure. That's really a fascinating process that's only characteristic of these insects that have complete development. You know, insects like grasshoppers that don't have this pupal stage, this rearrangement stage. It's a different sort of procedure. But what it's a great invention, this pupal stage, because what happens in, you know, when an egg hatches, the caterpillar develops, but there are little islands of undifferentiated cells, kind of like stem cells, that remain quiescent. They don't do anything. They're called imaginal discs. Imaginal means adult, basically, in scientific language. And they're quiescent until the hormonal cues that are associated with pupation and metamorphosis activate them. So you're absolutely right. What happens is the tissues of the caterpillar are broken down. These little islands of adult cells, the imaginal discs, become activated, and the adult structures grow from there. So it's not like they use the, you know, raw materials that have come from the caterpillar structures.
Is it a bit like, let's say, an apple where the those spiders that die and then the eggs feed on the body of the mother? It's kind of like a way of storing up a lot of nutrition in one area so that then the next stage can grow.
Not really, because it's like secondary sexual characteristics in humans. Get too far afield from
it. The only thing that's left of the caterpillar is its nutritional value as the other cells then grow and take over.
That Yeah, although it's not like, I mean, it's all part and parcel of the same insect. It's not like the caterpillar's gone and the butterfly. It's just, and in fact, some of the metamorphic changes that are not quite so complete, like in dragonflies, you can actually see some of the immature structures in the adult. It is pretty much more, I mean, it is almost total in the, I don't know of any anatomical features that are retained through that larval or the pupal adult. Larval pupil and adult mold. Yeah, but it's not like they're feeding the cells. It's just they're taking raw materials and rebuilding, reconfiguring them, I guess. So it's not nutrition as much as it is building blocks. So they're not digesting as much as reassembling.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All right, very
sure.
Good. And let's see, what's next here? Robinson, line 4. Hello.
Hello, May. I'm ashamed of asking this question. So many of David's listeners call in with questions, and I think, why don't they go to the library and look it up? But now that you're on, and I look forward to you, I've had a plague of large crickets in my house this season, an inch and a half or 2 inches long, and I want to know, what on earth could they be living on and growing to that size in a house?
So do they look pretty much cricket-like? They don't have any unusual features like a humped back or really...
Well, you can't get that close to them.
Oh, okay.
They're brown, shiny, and contrary to your thoughts, when I take a large Latin dictionary and try to drop them on them. They exist in my kitchen and in my bathroom and in my bedroom and my living room. And I'm not a great housekeeper. There are a lot of spiders they could eat if they, in fact, eat spiders. But do you know what they live on?
Well, crickets are the ultimate opportunists, actually. And unlike grasshoppers are pretty much vegetarians. Crickets will eat just about anything, so they're not at all fussy. They are actually considered house pests because of this omnivory of theirs. So they will eat stray plant material. You know, they can eat plant material. They can eat fungus. They can eat other animals, like you said, if they're small spiders. Anyway, so that's the problem. In fact, one notoriously famous cricket infestation was in a parachute packing factory, and they were eating the parachute silk, which you imagine did not make them welcome at all. But it really, they're kind of like cockroaches in that respect, that they are opportunists and will eat almost anything.
Okay, well, I've got almost everything around, so thank you.
All right, thank
sure.
you. Well, interestingly enough, also we had an email from somebody who had a cricket apparently suddenly appeared in their basement and said that someone told them it was a cave cricket.
Yeah, that's why I was asking about odd cave crickets are very strange looking crickets. Yeah,
oh,
and
okay.
They do show up in basements, and they look unlike anything you would expect. They're a different family, and they're sort of humpbacked, have very long antennae and very enlarged hind legs, and they look alien enough that people get worried when they see them, but
really?
They're just there, you know, cricket, field cricket relatives, not profoundly different. There are also mole crickets, which we don't see very often down here. You can see them in Florida and the like, have greatly enlarged front legs, which they use for burrowing like a mole does. So.
Well, we have crickets in our basement. I guess I never really looked at that. They didn't worry me too much and didn't look real closely. They're brown and they have that humpback. I guess I always thought they were like camel crickets. Is there?
Yeah.
Is that such a
yeah,
thing?
That's the same family, cave crickets and camel crickets.
Oh, okay. So they're...
In fact, as long as we're talking about movies, the Jerusalem cricket, which belongs to this family, is a very strange-looking creature, Steno palmatus, is the star of a sort of a horror film called The Unborn. I think there's dreams in which Jerusalem crickets appear only because their name is Jerusalem cricket. I don't know any other reason why they would appear. Sometimes they're called potato bugs. if you're storing potatoes in your basement, for example, like in a like people used to do, they'll get in there and cause some problems. But they're not very familiar looking because they like dark recesses and are sort of morphologically different enough from the standard issue cricket that they raise eyebrows.
All right. Well, let's see what we got here. We'll talk next with someone back here in Urbana. Line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Just so that May won't be worrying about gastropods for the next I did a bit of quick research, and they overwinter as adults or near adult immature.
Thank you. I wonder how they do it. I would suspect water loss would be a big problem in the winter, but
I'll have to do some more research. The Ohio,
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Master gardeners collectively.
All right, very good. Well, thank you.
But as soon as I'm back in my office, I will be reading up on
She's going to be
slugs.
You've distracted her from her more important study. She's going to be doing work on slugs. If the next time we see her, she says, I've got a new field of study. I'm going to be working on slugs. We know who's responsible.
Nah, not enough legs.
All right. Let's go to Belgium for another caller. Line four. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Inge. Mm. Good morning, Miss May. Get back to your movies. It seems like every one of these movies, they always have to be irradiated by some kind of radiation to make them grow large. And, you know, it's not nearly that difficult. All you got to do is put them in about 35% oxygen for a few millennia, and you'll get great big bugs.
Funny you should say that, because I got a call this week from a filmmaker in Chicago who wants to remake the movie Them about giant ants, but he wants it to be scientifically plausible. And I had suggested enriching the atmosphere with oxygen would be one way to make insects bigger, because historically the biggest they've been is about a 2-foot wingspan of proto dragonflies, which it's thought this size was made possible by the fact that the oxygen levels in the Carboniferous era were higher than they are today. And because of the constraints on the insect respiratory system, you'd need that extra oxygen. He thought that was intriguing, and we had an email exchange, and I told him you could get ants that were about, 2 inches long. And he emailed back and said, can't they be the size of, like, German shepherds? and still be plausible, but I'm afraid I cannot think of a plausible mechanism that will allow German shepherd-sized ants to be crawling around. He was disappointed. But you're absolutely right. Upping the oxygen would allow insects over evolutionary time. Unfortunately, most movies only last about an hour and a half, so it's hard to cover a few eons in that time span.
Kind of difficult to get a beetle the size of a Greyhound bus, you know what I mean?
That would be, it would not be on planet Earth, at least. Those are the words that they say right before the giant beetle comes through the wall, right? Okay. I should be careful.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we've talked about this before, I'm sure. They're actually, when you talk about giant insects, can you make it scientifically plausible? There are reasons why, in fact, no. You cannot have an ant that's the size of, whatever, choose your thing.
Insects are built the way they are because they are small. That design does not work when they're big. Ants, for example, they have, there's so many constraints. The respiratory system, which is basically a series of tubes that's lined with that outer lining, the cuticle, that delivers air directly to each cell. You would end up in a big insect with so many miles of tubing, it just would not be efficient. The jointed legs, they work they're basically hollow cylinders, but a very large weight would put so much pressure on the joints that they'd basically collapse. The exoskeleton has to harden because of the way it's made. They grow bigger by shedding their old skin, and then their new skin stretches, and then it hardens off, and then it remains hard. Well, if you were very large, the pull of gravity would be so great that before your exoskeleton would harden, it would basically sort of drop flat as a pancake, and they would lose their shape. So it doesn't, I mean, they're built the way they are because they are small. And that's the number one wrong assumption in all these movies, even movies that are regarded as critically successful. The remake of The Fly by David Cronenberg with Jeff Goldblum. I'm sorry, but when he's 6'4", even if he's a fly, he can't walk on the ceiling because he's 6'4". And gravity will work on him the same way as does on a man that's 6'4". Flies walk on the ceiling because they don't weigh very much. And surface forces are much greater than the gravitational forces. But a 6'4" fly would land up on the ground.
Well, so. You scientists, you just take the fun out of everything.
I do. Absolutely. I'm the worst person to sit next to during these movies.
You'd be the person sitting next to me. Well, you know why that really couldn't happen.
That's right.
Something else the listener said, and I think is interesting, it does, I'm sure it is true that when you look at those movies of the 50s, the problematic thing, and clearly it was something that we were all worried about at the time, was radiation.
Yep.
Do we now, though, have more movies where the thing is, it's genetic research, that's the thing?
Every new technology ends up as being the force that runs amok or has unintended consequences. Toxic pollution. We went through a whole range of. There was even when ozone was being depleted. I think it was called Day of the Animals, was sort of a UV light triggered disaster because all the ozone had been depleted. So whatever the technological challenge we face, if it's genetic engineering, then we have a whole slew of genetic engineering fear films. So we did have a whole festival devoted to genetically engineered insects.
To just get back, we're coming in, we got a couple minutes left, just to get back to the festival theme, the WASP theme, one of the things I wanted to ask you was that, you know, there are these two things that we might encounter that sting. Bees sting, wasps sting. Why is it we think that bees are nice, but we think that wasps are aggressive?
Well, actually, that's a relatively recent distinction. For a long time, they call them killer bees, right?
Well, they're, yes.
And they're not particularly friendly. But it's only recently people have gotten the message that bees and wasps are not the same. And even today, people often fail to differentiate between wasps, such as yellow jackets, and bees.
If it's all bees to them. At least I think
if it stings and it's vaguely yellow and black, it must be
a bee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, bees are strict vegetarians, and wasps actually, although they will visit flowers as adults, feed their kids meat, usually in the form of caterpillars or other, you know, soft-bodied prey, but very different lifestyles. Bees are characterized by what are called branched hairs. They're essentially hairy, fuzzy. If it's fuzzy with a couple of exceptions, it's probably not a bee. Bees need those branched hairs for carrying pollen. Wasps can pollinate, but they're not nearly as efficient as pollinators because they don't have as many branched hairs. The furriest wasp is actually called a velvet ant. It's not an ant at all. It looks like an ant, but it's very fuzzy. And they have a really nasty sting. The one in Texas is called a cow killer because it's got a sting packs such a punch. But again, wasps are not just the social species that sting. There are about 100,000 species of wasps, and the vast majority don't interact with humans much at all. They use their stinger / ovipositor. They inject venom, but they inject it into the bodies of caterpillars and other hosts and inject their eggs along with them. They're called parasitoids, and their grubs develop internally in the still living caterpillar, which is a pretty gruesome concept, and it's the inspiration behind the movie Alien, if you remember that one. When the caterpillar's complete development, they burst through the body wall of the caterpillar and spin little silken cocoons. We'll have some of those parasitoids at the festival, so you can put your arm into a cage full of wasps without facing any danger unless you happen to be a tobacco hornworm, in which case you should run for your life.
Now, we've talked a lot, I'm sure, when you've been here and when Phil has been here, our exterminator guy, poor Phil, about cicada killers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do. So I guess there's lots and lots of wasps that's essentially what they do.
Well, the cicada killers provision a burrow underground, so they don't lay their eggs inside their host, but they do make a number of underground cells and put eggs there.
Oh, I guess that's right.
They
paralyzed
it. Yeah, they paralyzed. They're still living.
That's the food source for them. But,
you know, the vast majority of wasps are beneficial. And there are even some wasps that pollinate orchids. And there are wasps actually in Japan. They're selling what they call it hornet juice. It's Vespa amino acids, VAA, I think is the abbreviation. And the sales pitch is basically it's like an energy drink. So VAM, it's called V-A-A-M, Vespa amino acid mixture. And you can buy it, and it's supposed to juice you up. So, and full of all kinds of amino acids and the like. So, so there are all kinds of beneficial. We have all kinds of beneficial relationships with wasps. These parasitoids are really important in biological control. So, not all wasps are out to kill you, festival name notwithstanding.
Well. Killer Wasps, the theme of the 28th Annual Insect Fear Film Festival that's taking place on the campus of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign this weekend. It's on Saturday in the Follinger Auditorium. It's free. Doors open at 6. So, there's the movies. The first one is The Monster from Green Hell, which is the more family-friendly one. And I imagine there will be some family-friendly entomologists there to answer questions and to talk about insects.
Yeah, we have we'll present the winners of the art competition from 6 to 7 there are all kinds of exhibits, petting zoo, bug scope, at 7:30 or so we have a couple of shorts and trailers, and then we go into the movies.
All right. Well, for now, we'll say thanks guest, Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. Look for her books in the library and the bookstore. And a few months from now, when things warm up a little bit, I'm sure it'll happen one day. She'll come back and we'll talk some more. Thanks very much for being
here. Thank you.